Hello, everybody, and welcome to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams. And today on the show, I'm going to be talking with my old professor, Fred Hand. He taught me when I was a grad student at Manus College of Music, where he still professes. And he is also the principal guitarist at the Metropolitan Opera House, the creator of the Renaissance Jazz Fusion Group, Jazz Antiqua. He studied under Bream. He's great. I mean, actually, I played one of his pieces when I was a kid out of Fred Node's solo guitar playing book, and I fell in love with a piece. It's in 5/4. It's this beautiful, lush piece. I mean, it was during some formative years artistically, so his name was always in my head as this guy. I think I used his piece, too, for, like, auditions after high school, like, and then eventually coming all the way from California through Texas to eventually study in New York City was the main thing. And then just falling into the, you know, I don't know, falling into Fred Hand's studio was, I don't know, it was a great, important part of my life. And I'm really excited that he's still part of it. We had a great conversation on this. We went out to lunch afterwards and had a much longer, more candid discussion. But what we got out of this interview is great. He talks about all of his experiences going to England with Bream. You know, you'll hear it. It's a great interview. It's very informative. And he's been around for a while, so you're going to get a lot of information, a lot of insight. Yet, like I said, he is at the Met, and I was at the Met all week. Not for playing purposes, because, you know, I don't know. I don't know how I'm going to break into that thing. But I was there to see the Wagner Ring Cycle, which has always been, I've always professed it to be my favorite work of music. And it's not only the music. If you know anything about it, it's also just it's a staple of Western art. It's one of the biggest, most grandiose pieces of Western art ever created. You know, in itself, it's almost a little bit of a wonder. But I'm a little bit of a formalist when it comes to art. You know, I try not to, do anything too associative when I'm judging it. And so I've always just been into the music. I just love that music. I love the quality of it. I love his orchestration techniques. Everything about that really gets me in almost a fetish sort of way. Like, I don't know, someone tickling me in a way I like or something. But I don't know why, but I know that there's a lot of us, and I was there with a sold-out audience to all four operas. Now, for those of you who don't know, there are four operas, Das Rheingold, Die Valkyrie, which is Ride of the Valkyries, that comes from that, and Siegfried, and then Götterdämmerung. The first opera, Das Rheingold, is 2.5 hours. The next two operas, Die Valkyrie and Siegfried, are 4.5. And the fourth opera is Götterdämmerung, Twilight of the Gods, and it's 5.5 hours. Now, the way it works is that it's spread out over a week. So it's almost got a festival quality to it. You see the same people. And by the fourth show, you're kind of, you know, saying hi or at least nodding to people, you know. And I was there, you know. I was there by myself for the most part. Wendy went to the first one with me. And, you know, if you're not into it, it's as you could, you know, guess, it's a little much. You know, I think it was after the second one. A guy was walking down the subway with his wife, and I heard him say, "So what'd you think? It's amazing, huh?" And she goes, "Yeah, it was a lot of everything." And she goes, "Like, never again." And it is a lot of everything, but it really depends. I mean, you gotta, like, I don't know. I have a connection with it. I've always said that I had a connection with it. And I was a little nervous going into it, because when I discovered these operas, and really, I did explore them. I studied them. I took classes on them. I really, really just wanted to know everything about these operas. And I thought it was maybe a move that I had done in my early 20s out of, I don't know, some sort of pretension. And I was afraid that now maybe I was a little too jaded, a little too grizzled to appreciate it in the same way. And that I would then just be stuck in the opera and at Lincoln Center buying $10 beers for a week. And exactly the opposite happened. It was a personal experience for me. It was more than I connected with it more than I do. I never cry. Last time I cried was when my dog died in 2004. And I was, I'll just admit it. I was tearing up the whole time. I mean, at least three times before, and by the time Gato Damrong, the fourth opera, came around, it was just, that trio, I love the trio with the three, what do you call them, ring weights, the little, they're like little mermaids, and they protect the gold anyway. I know it sounds ridiculous, but it really is, it's amazing. It was an amazing thing for me. And I've always wanted to do it. Wendy and my family and her family got together and all bought the tickets, because I can't, afford these tickets. It's ridiculous. These tickets are, and they got together and got it for my birthday. It was a huge surprise. I could never really afford to go with the dystonia. I couldn't write it off. I could have, 2 years ago, it would have been a tax write off, but because I'm not performing, my tax people said it wouldn't be a good idea. So I just, I didn't buy it. And, dude, it was really, really cool that they did it, but it's like these tickets are completely out of control, right? I mean, it's, if you just wanted to buy a ticket to it, a pretty modest ticket, like a family circle ticket, over $100, within 2 months of the opera, completely sold out, that kind of thing. First of all, I don't think you should have to pay over $100 for a ticket to anything, ever. It doesn't matter what it is, maybe to like sit down with the president and have a meal and shoot the shit. It should be over, maybe it should be over $100, but come on, it's ridiculous. And what you do, forget about Broadway. That's just garbage. But, Lincoln Center is, you're leaving out 90% of us. Really, and in particular, the artists. The people that are carrying the flag for you can't afford to go to these things. And when you do give people tickets, it's always to garbage or stuff that you can't sell, that you haven't sold out. So the thing is, I don't know. I don't know why they do that. I know why they do it. They say, oh, it's production costs. Bullshit. You ever realize that with the schools and all the institutions, and they never have enough money. Manus is always calling me up asking for more money. And I'm just sitting there going like, what in the hell? I already gave you, $30,000. Is that not enough? It seems like there's some sort of bureaucratic misspending or something going on at these colleges where they feel colleges and, all these academic institutions, fine arts institutions. I just don't get where the money's going. It's like, I know you got to keep the lights on, but God, it's a lot of money. Maybe I'm completely wrong, but I doubt it. I think something fishy is going on. They're not spending the money economically enough. It's probably all going to just, a couple of deans. Bob Carey, the senator, was the dean when I was at New School. Anyway, so the thing is, despite all that, I was planning on not being too, bitter. And I don't think I am. I had a great conversation with Fred, and I had a great time at the Met. Right? Everything's good, right? I'm okay. And I did. I came out of that okay, because I was also going into Lincoln Center thinking like, maybe I'm going to go into it and be bitter. Maybe I'm going to go into it and be jealous. And I wasn't. It was just me by myself at Lincoln Center for a week at a wonderful festival. And it was just what I needed to reconnect with why I got into this in the first place. And be something that's detached enough from the guitar to where I'm not thinking about my guitar problem the whole time, but definitely one with the music. And it started making me think about myself more as a composer and thinking about the importance of making music and how important it was to everybody in there. It wasn't just me. Everybody else was there. Sold out show, just sitting there for 5.5 hours, just being moved. I swear to God, it didn't feel like 5.5 hours. And if I go to like most guitar shows, I last about 20 minutes. Most of them. Some of them are great. But most of them. Don't tell anybody I said that. Anyway, this is a guy who I could always stand to watch for over an hour. This is Fred Hand. He's going to join us. I hope you stay tuned. And here it comes. Here comes Fred Hand.
Told you.
You're not listening?
Other
I just told
that,
you that.
What about when you were in Brooklyn? I mean, you were a kid in Brooklyn.
Yeah. Well, I had to fight, so I took a hammer. And
what was that like being a kid in Brooklyn? You're a New Yorker.
I am a New Yorker.
Never left.
Well, I live in Woodstock now.
Yeah.
You know, so, but I still feel like a New Yorker, and I'm in New York every week, several times a week. So, yeah, I just felt at a certain point I wanted to live in the country. But growing up in Brooklyn was fine. You know, when you, wherever it is that you grow up, that's the norm. Mm-hmm. So you just think, oh, this is home.
Yeah.
You know. But I grew up actually, I used to play a lot of basketball.
You?
Yes. Yeah, and I actually gave up the guitar for 3 years just to play basketball. I joined the Boys Club of America,
uh-huh.
and I was in a league, and we had uniforms and referees, and it was really great.
How tall are you?
Now?
Yeah. Well, now, have you shrunk?
Well, no, but you see, back then I was really short, and that was the whole thing.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, well, you're not that short.
You didn't say how tall you were. You said how tall are you. I'm 5'6", not even, okay? But then I was under 5 feet. And I have to tell you, I would go into where the tall trees are, you know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah.
I'd get crushed.
What was your position?
I was guard. I was point guard.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. But I love basketball. But now here's the thing. So I went to see
So you were good. Point guard's good.
I was pretty good. I went to see the New York Knicks. So remember, I was playing the guitar from 9 to 12. Then I stopped playing the guitar and I played basketball. And then I went to see the New York Knicks. And the shortest guy, even way back then, the shortest guy was 6'3". Okay.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
And I thought about it, and I thought, you know, I don't see a big future for me here. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, me neither.
So, yeah. So I went back to playing the guitar, and that's really, I really got serious about it. And I started studying with Albert Valdez Blaine, who's a protege of Segovia, and he was one of the main New York teachers at that time.
Yeah.
And he really whipped my ass, you know. He straightened things out. My hands, look, you know, this is a radio, so you can't see, but, you know, it's like, and they were gnarled up, and he got me in a good position and taught me how to play. Not to mention, you know, you walk in for a lesson, and he had these old Hauser guitars and beautiful Velasquez guitars. And
he said, had
yeah,
those?
Yeah, he says, just pick one up and play it, you know, so I could play on the greatest guitars.
Oh, so he was like, so he was the New York guy back then.
He was it.
There was nobody else.
Well, there was. There was a Julio Prohl was also around, and he was.
And this is what, the 50s? 40s.
Hey, stop.
30s.
Stop. No, it was the 1840s.
1870s.
It was the, I'll tell you what it was.
Richard Wagner visited
it was the early 60s.
Okay.
All right?
Yeah.
Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, absolutely. Yeah, no, I believe you.
Yeah.
I believe you. I don't think you're that old.
I'm very reassured that you actually believe what I'm saying.
Are you afraid that I think you're really old now?
I really don't care.
I don't think you're that old. It's because of the where I used to say that I would get the Met job when you died. And
yeah.
I think ever since then you've been sensitive I think
it's very funny.
On his last lap.
I thought that was really funny. Because what you don't know is that my family, I'm serious, we live to be like into our mid-90s.
Okay.
So if you want to wait 30 years.
I don't think I'm
Because, you know, the only way I'm going
anyway.
To leave, you know the way I'm going to leave the Met? It's when they say, get old guy off the stage.
You didn't hear him say that?
I can't hear him because I've lost my hearing completely. I didn't even hear what you just said. What did you just say?
I said, I think you were talking about basketball. Yeah. You were talking about how basketball, so when you did that, first of all, back to Brooklyn for a second. Mm-hmm. I actually read in Julia Crowe's book, her interview with you, where you broke your guitar.
Yeah. Well, that was weird because I went, at that time, the music store for guitar in New York City was called the Spanish Music Center. That's where everyone went to buy music.
It sounds awesome. I wish it was still here instead of
I do
here.
Too. Oh, yeah. Well, it was a version of that. You
oh,
know?
What?
And they sold, they're not around anymore, but there was a factory in Long Island called Tatai Guitars. And they were really from Spain. They were from Valencia.
Mm-hmm.
And they made these guitars that were in, well, they were not cheap, you know. But at that time, a $100 guitar was a big deal,
yeah.
you know. And so we bought this guitar for me. As I say, I was 9 years old. And the owner, his name was Gabriel Oler, said the strangest thing to me because he had no knowledge of my interest in sports or baseball or anything. And as I was leaving the store, he said, now don't be putting a baseball bat through that guitar.
Yeah.
Why would you say that to someone? I mean, that's the weirdest thing.
It's
a weird thing to say.
It's not even, yeah, it doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense. But now here's the thing. 2 weeks later, I had the guitar lying on my bed, and I was in my room practicing, swinging both from the left side and the right side. I wanted to be a switch hitter. Right side was my natural side. So the left.
Why'd you want to be a switch hitter?
Mickey Mantle. Even though I was a Brooklyn Dodgers fan.
That's what
fan,
I'm saying. I thought you were a Dodgers fan.
Totally.
But everybody
I used to
loves
go to Ebbets
Mickey
Field.
Mantle.
But Mickey Mantle.
Mickey Mantle's
okay.
I mean, that's how I feel about Derek Jeter. I don't like the Yankees, but I love Derek Jeter.
I love Derek Jeter.
Anyway, so go ahead.
You don't like the Yankees? This interview's over.
No, I thought you didn't like the Yankees. Oh, no, you Yankees. Switched sides.
I switched sides.
You fucking switched sides.
I did. However, I did play the lute at Shea Stadium, but that's another story.
Aww,
I did.
See? And now...
Yeah, what the hell? Anyway, can we stick on one story?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Remind me, what was I saying?
You were talking. You
oh,
said
about the
that
guitar.
The owner of the Spanish.
Yeah.
Music.
So he said, "Don't put a baseball bat through the guitar." So now
then he sold to you.
2 weeks later, I'm practicing my left-handed swing, and admittedly, a little less control from the left side. Mm-hmm. And I do my follow-through, and the end of the baseball bat goes right through the side of the guitar.
Jesus, don't put a baseball bat through the guitar, he said.
He told me not to. Maybe I missed that word, not. You know. Okay, so then I took it to 48th Street, which it, you know, at the time was like there's a million music stores, and mm-hmm. you figure you could get the guitar fixed. No one would touch it.
Why?
Because it was like a million little pieces of wood.
It
shattered.
Was it the face?
No, it was the side. The side of the instrument.
Okay.
So I had still have, although he's no longer 15. I have a cousin. He was my big cousin, Stevie. Okay. I was 9. He was 15. And yeah. Stevie, even then, was a terrific woodworker. That he wound up becoming a fantastic furniture maker. And Stevie knew how to bend wood, steam it and bend it. And he steamed a piece of wood and bent it and put it on the inside of the guitar. And then, like a puzzle, like a mosaic, he glued each little tiny piece back.
Oh, what a sweet guy, Stevie.
And he fixed that guitar.
And now you have it.
I still do have it. It's hanging on my wall.
Oh, man. My first guitar, I sold it to a friend for $200, and I still talk to the guy once in a while just because I know he's got the guitar.
Does he let you play the guitar?
I'm like, hey, what are you doing at Christmas? You know, stuff like that. No, he has it. He's in Santa Cruz somewhere.
Santa Cruz.
Doing social
work. It's a nice part of the world.
It's kind of nice. You know, it's kind of weird, though, out there in Santa Cruz.
How is it
have
weird?
You ever really spent time there? I'm from that little triangle that
well,
San Francisco
how far is. How far is it from, where did John
San
Gilbert?
San Francisco.
Well,
the Redwoods, where he lives?
John Gilbert used to live in Woodside. Do you know where Woodside is?
No,
I think. It's south of San Francisco.
That's what I think. I think he's near the trees and stuff where he is.
Well, so I know that area a little
bit. Or where he was.
And it's very pleasant.
It's very pleasant. Okay, this is the thing about Santa Cruz. It is pleasant.
Yeah.
But it's also like, I don't know. It's kind of haunted in a strange way.
Can I just say it's so good to see you, Brett?
It's good to see you, too.
I used to see you every week.
I know.
And then you just stopped coming around.
That's
not
true.
Did you complete your education at Manus? Because I don't know what happened.
I completed...
Brett is at 1 o'clock. Where is he?
Who do you like now? Do you like any of your students now?
I like all of my students now.
Do you?
You honestly expect me to sit here and say, no, I don't like this guy.
Well, who do you... I mean...
But I actually do like all my students.
Well, I mean... I know that, you know, the year that Giacomo and I were there and maybe Andy and Paul, that was a fun time for you.
It was a great year.
One of your favorite classes?
It was.
Tell me about a couple of your favorite classes at Manus.
That was one of my favorite classes, if you mean that time period.
Yeah.
And this current time period is very similar to that in who I have to teach. And that is, you know, really good students, but also terrifically funny and interesting. And, you know, you just have each lesson is like a great time.
Yeah.
You know, it's serious work. We're doing really good serious work, but you really enjoy it.
Yeah.
And that's, it has its, you know, when I walk into the building, you know, I maybe because I've just come back down from Woodstock, I'm a little tired, whatever. 6 hours later, that's a long time, you know, to go straight. I got more energy than when I came in because of the exchange with the students.
Right. And so this is one of your favorites too.
It is.
What about before that? Before us, was there any period in the 90s or the 80s or the 70s or the 60s or the maybe the 40s when you were teaching?
Yeah.
Did you ever teach in a bow tie? Did you ever wear a bow tie?
No, I never did. I never did.
I'm just going.
Yeah, I wanted to see where you would stop if the cutoff was the 40s.
19 teens. So the thing is, who
is there a question in there somewhere?
No, there's no questions.
Okay.
There's no questions.
Yeah, no answers either. And you want to just keep moving on?
Yeah,
we just
keep moving on. We edit.
Okay, so then, you know, I wanted to go to college. And at that time, there were only two schools in the United States you could study guitar. One was American University in Washington, and the other was Manus College of Music.
That's it?
That was it. And I chose Manus.
Why'd you choose Manus?
Because I'm a New Yorker. And they had a good reputation too.
Yeah,
you know. And it was and still is a great school. I had a great education there.
Yeah.
And I was taught, because at that time there weren't too many, hardly any real master guitarists around. Yeah. And the person who started the program was a violinist, a great violinist named Leonid Bolotin, who played the guitar, but that was not his main instrument. His main instrument was the violin. But the result was, I mentioned to you that I had, because of Albert Valdez Blaine, he actually really set my technique, and he was very helpful.
Oh, so now I could play. You're set.
So, well, I would say not completely set, but I was a long way, and so I could be taught by a master musician. And he wasn't too concerned with how you make something happen. He said, you can take care of that, but here's what has to happen in the music, what should happen. And he would just do it by playing, you know, by singing, playing his violin. And it was wonderful. It was a great education.
So you, I had no idea that that was the case. So you actually learned during your college years, you were taking lessons with a violinist.
Yes, that's right. Although he would probably not be flattered by it. He would say, well, I play the guitar. And he did play the guitar.
No, that's such
but that wasn't his thing. He took up the guitar late in life.
You know? It was such a thing back then, because Elliot Fisk and, you know, Kirkpatrick, is that right?
Right.
The you know, so, yeah, he was taking harpsichord lessons.
I think it would be great.
Violin. So there were just, there weren't enough guitarists.
No, it was in a very different place. You know, it's amazing. You're too young to really
it's the opposite problem. There's too many of us.
Okay. Well, we can do something about that. Where's that hammer? But no, really, there weren't too many people to study from, and to see what's happened in the space of 50 years, it's a staggering development.
Yeah,
you know, the guitar now. I mean, what
there's junior college programs. I mean, it's
listen, I gave a presentation for a GFA symposium here in New York, and they had competitions at different age groups. You know, and there were these 4-year-olds sitting out in the hallway. I'm going like, oh my God. It wasn't just that they could play. They had the moves. These were like serious musicians. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They were playing from a deep place. It was whoa.
Yeah.
Impressive.
Yeah. It's pretty impressive. Yeah. I mean, even since I started, you know, I'm working with kids now they're starting to open up programs like at the special music school and stuff for kids. And I mean, some of these kids are just, I mean, they're going to be, they're already doing college level work.
It's amazing.
Theoretical. I mean, they're already studying, you know, college level theory.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's, yeah, we're going to see, it's leaps and bounds with this instrument every 5 years.
They're going to want my job when I die.
They're going to want my job when I die, which is, I don't even know what it is. This is my job.
This is part of your job right now. You're doing it. This is your life right now.
That's what you always said. So when you went to college, you studied violin, and then I think you went
No, I didn't study violin. You got to listen carefully.
You studied guitar. You studied. Study guitar.
Try to pay.
Study guitar with a violinist. Let me just wake up here for a second.
Yeah, I know it's early. It's afternoon.
Yeah, I know. It's like wake up time for me.
But for you, for New York time, that would make it a little afternoon.
That's right. what about the when did Bream come into it?
Well, Segovia was the reason I took up the guitar, because I went to see him when I was 6 years old. And honestly, at that that first concert, I turned to my mom and I said, "That's what I'm going to do."
Yeah,
and 3 years later, she actually took me seriously and got me a guitar. When I was seeing him every year at Town Hall.
Wait, how old were you when you went to the Segovia concert?
6, and I said, "That's it. That's what I'm going to do."
At 6?
Yep. And I kept asking for a guitar, and she said, "Well, what about a ukulele?" I said, "No, no."
See, guitar. You're a special person, then.
I knew. I'm not kidding. Yeah. I don't know how I knew. And so at 9, she finally said, "Okay, well, here you go. Here's a guitar." And after a year, I was like ahead of my teacher, who was studying from really fine guitarist named Manuel Gayol. Right. So he was my second. So he just took me to his teacher. And I studied for 3 years. And then from there, I studied with Valdez Blaine and then on to college, you know. But here's what happened. So I was a Segovia devotee for the first, from 6 to about 15. And then Julian Bream burst on the scene. And here was this guy playing the lute, and he was playing modern music. And he was talking with this Cockney accent, and he was funny, and he could play the hell out of the guitar, you know. And it was like my focus, just my orientation was Segovia. Thank you, Julian Bream. You know,
really. So you really fell in love with him?
Totally. I just wanted. I not only did I play like him, I even talked like him, and I got I caught a lot of hell because what is a kid from Brooklyn talking with a Cockney accent? You know. So, but Julian Bream offered a master class in Canada when I was 19 years old. So I was at Manus, and I submitted a tape. I remember I played the Prelude, Fugue, and Allegro, and I was accepted. And it was a great class. And I remember playing ping pong with him, and we sort of got along, you know. And so I would then go see him when he came to
me. And how old was he at that point? I mean,
he was in his mid-30s.
Uh-huh.
And he was just crushing everything. I mean, he was just making those incredible recordings, and oh, it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I kept in touch with him, and he actually, during the class, he selected me to play for the BBC. So that was a great honor, you know, that he chose me out of, because there were some really fine players there. But in any case, so we stayed in touch, and then I graduated from Manus. I started teaching at the University of Connecticut. It was a nice job, but I kind of got this feeling sort of like, so is this it? Now this is what I'm going to do? Like it's all over? And then I got this idea to study some more, and I'd love to really study intensely with Julian Bream.
Yeah.
I didn't know if that was possible. What I decided to do was apply for a Fulbright. Now, when you apply for a Fulbright, you have to write, at least you did then, I'm sure you do now, a substantial essay on why you want to study in a certain country, what you're trying to do. And it would have been if I was just totally honest, a very short, I want to study with Julian Bream. Yeah. That's it. Right? That would not go over too well with the Fulbright Commission.
No, they want you to learn about English culture and
well, they want to see more than that, right? Yeah. So Julian Bream, like most guitarists, uses free stroke and rest stroke. But he has a little tiny different thing he does with the rest stroke. He pushes in a little bit, you know, into the guitar.
Yeah.
And he calls it the top stroke. So I wrote an essay, rather lengthy essay, on the top stroke and how Julian Bream was the foremost exponent of the top stroke. And this is what my work was going to be about.
Oh, that'll work.
It did work.
That'll work.
It did work.
Yeah, they'll love that. We've completely reinvented a way to play the guitar. Exactly. Well, thank you, sir. Please.
There you go. There you go. So now the Fulbright works in stages like a competition. So at the point at which I got past a few rounds and I realized that I had a chance to get this, I called Julian Bream up. And I asked him, I said, I have this opportunity perhaps to study with you. Would you be willing to teach me in England? And he said, why, of course. Is that why you're calling?
That's a wonderful accent, Fred.
It doesn't sound anything like him, but I'm doing my best here. Well, it sounded a little bit like that. And I said, is that why you're calling? Like, I wouldn't even have to call him? I said, yeah, I just want to call. He said, well, of course. So, yeah, I said, well, thank you so much. This is incredible, wonderful. And then I proceeded on with the Fulbright, and I got the scholarship. So I had just now cut to September. I had just gotten married. I left my job at the University of Connecticut. I left my New York apartment, gave all that up. We moved to England. We were so
crazy. Now, was this Leslie or was this somebody else?
This is my first wife.
Okay.
Whose name was Joy.
Okay.
And wife number one, we'll refer to her.
Wife number one.
Yeah. And we went to England, and we even took our Volkswagen car, which had the steering column on the wrong side. You mentioned how bringing a lot of stuff over.
How'd you do that?
You shipped it. You figured it would be cheaper to do that than to buy a car over there or rent a car for a year.
Yeah, but not these days.
I don't know about that.
I don't have any idea, but I just
Can we move on? Can we just move on? I don't know if we're going to talk about renting cars now.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So we get over there, and there's the first 3 days is an orientation in London. We'll talk about the cars later.
I want to talk about cars. All right. Go ahead.
Okay. So anyway.
No, I'm sorry. I really don't want to talk about cars. Okay. I just wanted to.
So we're over there, first 3 days in London orientation. I call Julian Bream up, and I say, hi, Julian. It's Fred. I'm in London now. He says, hello, Fred. How are you? And I go, well, I'm good. How are you? Oh, fine. He says, what brings you to London?
Fucking forgot about the whole thing?
I went, oh, my God. I said, I'm here to study with you. And he said, study with me? I said, yeah, here to study with you.
I got a car and I'm on a boat right now, pal.
Yeah, yeah. So he said, but I don't teach. And I went, oh, my God, what am I going to, you know? Think about it. I mean, not only did I give up all that stuff, but I told everybody. Everybody knew I was going to study with the great Julian Bream. And he said, I don't teach. And I said, well, but I called you. I called you. Remember, I spoke to you and I asked you and you said it was okay. He said, I thought you were going to study in France. And I said, study in France? Who did I say I was going to study with in France? He said, oh, I don't know. And I went, oh, at this point, I'm just like, you know, having a heart attack.
I mean, were you like angry?
I didn't, No, no. I was more like devastated. Okay. So, but then,
okay,
like on a dime, he shifts and he says, I'm making a recording right now. He says, pop by next week.
Did you have to tell him a sob story or something? Were you like, look, I moved
everything. All I remember is
him. Were you almost in tears, right?
Well, that came later. You know, I'll tell you what, because this isn't over yet. So he says, well, I'm making a recording. Pop by next week and we'll have a chat. And I thought, oh, this is going to be a disaster, right? So I drive out to his home in the country in Dorset County. Gorgeous, you know. And he takes me into this room. And this is a room where he has all his plaques, like his gold records and stuff, you know, award-winning, all his awards and everything. He sits me down on the sofa, and he kind of stands over me. So the dynamic is I'm down on the sofa with my back to the wall, and he's hanging over me, and he's saying, well, now, you know I don't teach, which, in fact, I didn't know he didn't teach because he never said he didn't teach, and he actually agreed to teach me. So that kind of a little misleading. But he's kind of got his hand, you know, like – you know, like he's wagging his finger. You know, I don't teach. Blah, blah, blah. And then, here's where I literally sweated through my shirt.
Okay? You're right, yeah.
And then the phone rings. And he says, just a second, I'll be right back. And he answers the call. I have no idea who called. He comes back into the room and he says, well, okay, then, let's have a lesson. Look, just stay with me on this.
Okay.
And I go, wow. And my head is spinning. I thought, like, he's not going to teach me. Now he says, let's have a lesson. And the next thing I know, we're in this room, his music room, and he's playing the guitar. And I'm sitting as far away from him as I am from you now, and I'm thinking, this is Julian Bream playing the guitar for me. And I'm like, I can't believe this. But I can't really hear anything he's saying. He's explaining things, and I'm just, like, still back on the sofa with, you know, getting beaten up. Right.
This is your hero. This is the
total hero.
More than Segovia at this point. This is your guy.
Much more. This is my guy. You know?
He still is.
Still is. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So, and here's the thing. After that, he couldn't have been nicer. He couldn't have been more generous. The lessons, he just said, well, look, you know, I'm going to go on tour now. No, we can get together this time and this time.
Yeah.
And I said, great. That's fine. That's wonderful. You know, and the lessons only ended when I had nothing more to play. So as long as I still had something to play, so like a 4-hour lesson, you know, I mean, he'd just keep going. So that was the experience. It was a little crazy, you know, but on the other hand, he was fantastic.
Was he an expensive teacher?
Well, that, you know, that's an interesting thing. The Fulbright Commission wanted to pay him because they pay everybody, mm-hmm. right? And he was actually pissed off. He got these letters from the Fulbright Commission. And all day it was just some guy doing his job saying, we would like to reimburse you for teaching Fred Hand. And he said to me, you can't put a price on my lessons. You know, so he just threw the papers away. He never got paid anything. He didn't want to.
Okay, so it was free.
It was free for him.
And he didn't get paid.
He didn't get paid because he wouldn't.
He had money though, right? Did he have money? I mean, his recordings where he was.
I would say John Williams was doing well.
There yet, or was he just about the guy? He's a little bit younger, right?
He's younger. John Williams is younger, and John Williams was playing. In fact, they were playing together,
and they were playing that duo.
They were playing that duo because they had just come out with an album,
with La Vie Breve and stuff like that.
Right, and Bream said to me, "Have you heard that album?" I said, "Oh yeah." He said,
"Yeah."
And can you tell who's playing which part? And I said, "Yes, I can.
Yeah, I can.
Yes, I can." He said, and then he said, "Really?" I said, yeah, really.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious, pal.
He was really kind of fishing. He wanted to know what I thought. No, of course, I thought it was great and all that kind of thing. But he kind of wanted some feedback. It was interesting.
He wanted to know whether you liked him or John Williams.
Well, he wanted, yeah, pretty much.
That's weird.
So, yeah, but they were, John Williams was already a prominent, you know, had his own career. And they were friendly rivals, put it that way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I always looked at those two, and maybe I think a lot of people might look at it as Julian Bream's sort of the fire gusto, just throwing it out there. John Williams, the laid back technical marvel.
That's pretty accurate.
Is that about right?
Yeah, that's my take on it. Yeah.
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 Yeah. And you and I mean, I've always been sort of the camp of, you know, let's put some soul into it. Let's put some balls into it. And that's what Julian Bream does.
I just want you to know, John Williams speaks very well of you.
Is that what he said? Yeah. He's always thinking about me. He probably lost a lot of sleep.
Yeah. He said, how's Brett?
God, you know, yeah. He's like, I always think Brad is the kind of guy who puts his balls on the table.
You know, to say that I don't want to touch
that what John Williams is
can't touch
right
that.
Now? Okay, we won't talk about him anymore. But so, yeah, so that's it. So you study with him for free because of his
Because it was, I mean.
Well, he just wasn't interested.
Eccentricities.
He's very, that's a good word. He's very eccentric. Do you know, you'd walk into his house, and the first thing you'd see on the table when you walk in is a stack of mail. Like, way high, like he didn't open his mail.
He's just one of those guys.
He's one of those guys.
Yeah. And you're not one of those guys. You're very, you're always had like a nice clean
I
house.
I open my mail.
And you all, you, I mean, you also have one of those things, an air purifier from Brookstone or something, don't you?
I do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Remember, you got an air purifier tower. Now you're being all Julian Bring me.
Oh, I did. No, I didn't. I remember now. You know what? That was the kind that they later found out was not good for you, those towers.
It's
that,
like an ionic breeze.
An ionic breeze. That's what it was.
And you don't have that anymore?
I don't, but now we're looking to buy another air purifier.
Wait, what happened?
Well, I read that it causes some horrible thing. I forget, cancer or something. Didn't you read about that?
No.
Oh, they're no good.
Oh, you were so into it. I mean, it definitely, you, well, you had.
It makes the air smell good. That's
because
for sure.
You had like that, you had like this dug into the mountainside sort of.
Yeah.
There's loft on the bottom of your house.
Right, I had a wood burning stove, a lot of dust in there, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a good thing to have, but I think we got to move,
unless it gives
move
you,
to the next.
Unless it gives you a giant tumor.
That, yeah, and then you might want to look for another product.
All right. So when you were done with Brain.
Yes.
How do you like how this is going?
So far, I don't know. I'll give you a review at the end.
No, that's the way everybody has been. Everybody like mid-interview just goes like, oh, Jesus, what are we talking about?
Yeah.
So when you are, you do the Bream and then you come back to the United States after
I come
after
back.
That?
Now, here's the interesting thing. By the time
the wife's still with you? Or
yes,
how did that
the
happen?
Wife's still with me. The wife is still with me. But by the time I actually get to study with Julian Bream, my interest is already starting to shift into composition, into wanting to integrate more of my musical personality, which involved jazz.
Yeah.
So the first thing that I did when I came back to the United States was I made a recording. One half was jazz with great jazz musicians, Hubert Laws and Richard Davis, and these fabulous all-star musicians, Joe Chambers. And the other half was classical. And I just wanted to have that, I think it was called Double Image or Double Exposure. Yeah, that was the name of the album. And I just wanted to have both those facets. So there was already internally, or you might say spiritually in me, something shifting. And here I was, finally the culmination of my dreams of studying with, you know, Julian Bream. And already artistically I was moving, I could feel it somewhere else. And I made that album, and then someone said to me, you know, it's nice that you can do both of these things, but if you could somehow integrate these things, you'd have something. And I thought about it, and at the time it just seemed like, well, I don't know. It has to happen organically. That didn't really speak to me. But I was always interested in early music, and I was starting to get calls to play the lute in improvisatory settings, you know, where they just needed somebody to fill that kind of thing. So I was doing a lot of improvising, and I love that stuff. And in fact, that's how I got the job at the
Met.
Just
like some Vivaldi and stuff like that?
No, it was earlier than that. It was Renaissance music where they would just –
just look
at
for
most
some color.
Have a bass line.
Yeah.
And a bass line, and they say, just play some chords under us, play some rhythm, play some time, which is very much like a jazz pianist comping, you know?
Yeah.
And then occasionally they say, we'll take a solo.
Well, that's called, whatchamacallit, where you fill in the chords above the figured bass.
Well, that figured bass is a little later. It's exactly the same idea, but in the Baroque period,
but you
they
were
actually
just
put the figure. This is figured bass without the figures.
Right.
So you literally had to just
that's
jump
what I'm saying.
In. You just have to jump in and like then listen and hear, oh, that's not a root position chord or whatever.
Yeah.
You know? So I did that, and I was working with a wonderful group called Calliope. And the fellow who was in charge, his name is Ben Harms, is also a percussionist at the Met. And the Met was just about to mount a production of Francesca da Rimini, which needed a lute player. So they asked, knowing that he's a Renaissance guy, they said, who do you use for lute? And he mentioned me. And that's how I got, initially, the job playing at the Met. And so my first experience walking out on stage in rehearsal, and the first person I see is Placido Domingo, and the second person I see is James Levine. And I'm, you know, I'm not a kid, but I'm, you know, and I'm looking up at the opera house, and I'm thinking, this is great.
Yeah.
This is fantastic.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah.
And
big time.
This is big time. And you know,
bigger than you ever imagined.
And I suppose I should have been intimidated, but I was excited.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just excited, and I was ready. I was prepared. So yeah, let's do this. You know,
right.
And so I did that. Oh, I'm sorry. Am I making?
Oh no, don't worry about it.
Okay,
a little bit.
So I did the run of the show in New York, and then they took it on tour, and then we went all over the country playing this, and You know, they amplified the loop by putting a little wireless wireless remote, you know, set up with a contact mic on the loop. And I was told at the beginning of each show, like at 6 o'clock, to go to the theater and meet with the sound guy and set the levels, which I did. And after the first show, he didn't show up. So when I saw him later on, I said, "Hey, what's up?" And he said, "Oh, you don't need to keep doing that, right?" So, okay. So then we did the next city, and next city, it all went fine. Now we get to the last city, which was Detroit. And the first bit that I did was actually backstage with the chorus. So I'm not aware of what's going out into the house. I'm backstage. So I do that. Then I walk out on stage, and I start to play, and I hear the sound of the lute hit the back of the auditorium and come back at me like a rock concert. I mean, yeah. Really loud, unbelievably loud. And I look down and I see Maestro Levine, and he's like gesturing like, you know, hold it down, hold it down. But of course, it's nothing I could do. I mean, I'm just barely touching the strings and it's just juiced, you know. So I play and that ends the act one. Okay. And then this curtain comes down and I hear James Levine storm out of the pit. He gets a hold of the sound man. We can curse. Is that okay to use?
Oh, yeah.
I'll tell you what he said. He said, "What do you think this is, a fucking Jimi Hendrix concert?" He says to the sound man. So, and then I was told that on that night, and you know, the lute, let's face it, the lute is a puny instrument, right?
Yes.
It hardly makes any noise, yeah. Right? So I was told that the lute had drowned out the entire Metropolitan Opera Orchestra and chorus. Yeah, but you know what I said when I heard that? I said, "Yes!" Yeah, baby.
Right, right.
And then it was intermission. Yeah. And I would go downstairs, and there's this huge room. And the whole orchestra is like off to one side of the room. And then there's this corridor. And on one end of the corridor, they saw James Levine walking towards me. And on the other side, I'm walking towards him. And they see all this hand gesturing. You know, it just looks very animated. And what was actually happening was I was waving my hand saying, "I'm so sorry, you know, I couldn't do anything. I couldn't control the sound." And he's waving his hand saying, "Oh, no, I know it's not your fault," right? So that was what was actually going on.
Okay.
But when the musicians, you know, this is a big thing. When something like that happens, it's like, wow, this is cool. Let's find out what happened, right?
Yeah, right.
So they come up to me and they say, "So what did you say? What did he say?" So I said to him, "Listen, man, you know, if you're going to feature me like that, I want my bread." And they looked at me because they didn't know me. It was the first time I was working on it. They said, "You said that to the maestro?" I was just being myself, you know.
Right,
eventually they learned that, you know, not to take me too seriously.
That's the way it goes. So that was the first thing that happened when you came back? I mean, that was it?
No. I think the first thing I mentioned was the – it was a little out of order. The first thing that happened was that recording.
Yeah,
the Met was actually about 10 years later, actually. So I made that recording, and then I was playing early music. I skipped about 10 years here, but I'll fill it in. And so what happened was I was playing these beautiful pieces, but, you know, I'm also a composer and an arranger, and I was hearing more contemporary harmonies. I was hearing jazz. I was hearing, you know, a lot of the medieval music is very modal. So you could start playing modal stuff like John Coltrane, and it sounded great over it.
Yeah.
So I started in my concerts, I was doing solo concerts, but I started to bring a bass player with me so we'd have some improvisation.
Yeah.
And that led eventually to me wanting to – then a bass player was fine, but then it was like I want to hear a melody instrument.
In your solo concerts, are you playing your own music at this point?
I am. Okay. Not exclusively. It's always a mix, but
right.
more and more I'm playing my own music.
Yeah.
And now I'm starting to add improvisation into it. And now I'm wanting to hear more. I'm wanting to hear percussion. I'm wanting to hear one melody instrument. Once I hear one melody instrument, then I want to hear a counterline. So I form a group, and the group was Jazz Antiqua.
Yeah, sure.
And that kind of bringing together these two styles, which someone had told me way back when, which didn't mean anything to me then. He just said jazz and classical. But now it was organic. Because I was really feeling it. You know, I was really feeling the Renaissance and the medieval.
Jazz and Renaissance is what it is, right?
That's exactly right. And I got musicians who could really do both. And we had a really successful run. We did it for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
We had an album with RCA, BMG.
Yeah, I have that album.
And we played at the biggest colleges all over the country. It was great. We went to South America. The only thing is, when you have a group, I mean, even if you have a duo, you know, it's like a marriage, right?
Yeah,
if you have a group with six people or seven people, that's seven marriages. Right?
That's a goddamn commune.
There you go. And, you know, there is a saying that all groups end, right? Or all groups break up, I think.
I guess so, yeah.
And after 7 years, remember, I was writing the music. I was writing all the arrangements. We had a manager, but I was still managing a lot of it myself.
Was that your favorite time artistically?
I think that's one of the best things I ever did, for sure. The most fulfilling.
It just seems to come up a lot, and you know what I mean? I know what it's like to start a group and how important it is. And,
right.
You know.
It was definitely a great time in my life. I'll say that. And it really was incredibly fulfilling. The concerts were beautiful concerts.
What do you think about that versus the solo stuff that you were doing before?
Well, I think it was all fine, but this was, as I say, it was an organic process of growing into who I was to become. You know, I was becoming something other than a solo performer.
Right.
And where playing solo couldn't fulfill, especially compositionally, what I needed to hear, what I wanted to hear.
Yes.
So that's the artistic part of me, okay, was being fulfilled in that way. And I was still doing solo concerts, but there was something else going on in that being a New Yorker. I was being called to play on record dates and film scores and that kind of, so I was kind of plugged into a little more of a commercial scene. Even though I'm not a commercial guitarist, I don't play electric guitar, but I was being called to do a lot of stuff.
So Jazz Antique, well, I sort of interrupted and wanted to talk about solo versus ensemble work, but with the, you were talking about, I think I kind of threw you off a little bit
I was just saying that around the same time as I was doing jazz, well, sort of, I would say after I had done Jazz Antique for a few years, I got a call. Actually, the way this happened, and it's a very, I think, interesting how one's career develops, and you never know who you meet or who's listening, that what's going to lead to what. Because I'm going to just jump back to when I was a student at Manus, and they would send us out on these gigs to play at parties, you know, at somebody's townhouse. And I remember doing this gig. I was probably 20 years old, and I was sitting there playing Bach. And, of course, no one's listening, and everyone's making noise. And I just think, let's just get through this, right?
Yeah.
And get whatever they paid you and get out of there. But there was one guy. I could see him at the end of the room listening. And I kept playing, and he kept moving closer and closer until eventually he sat down right next to me, which was a little odd, you know, because I'm playing Bach and this guy sitting right next to me. And then when I finished the piece, he introduced himself. He says, "Hi, I'm Gene Bertoncini." Gene Bertoncini is a legendary jazz guitar player. He used to play in the Tonight Show band when it was in New York with Johnny Carson. Great, beautiful guy, beautiful guitar player. And we became friends, you know. He said, "Let's get together," and we hung out, and he's to this day just a brilliant guitar player. And Gene was totally plugged into commercial
TV
and stuff. So Gene got a call one day. They needed a guitarist, As the World Turns. It was a scene. Meg Ryan had started on As the World Turns, and they needed a scene, Spanish guitar music, because they were shooting some scenes in Spain. And Gene says, "Well, yeah."
Meg Ryan was on All the World Turns.
Oh, yeah. That's what she started.
Soap opera?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So Gene said, "Well, I don't really do that, but call this guy, you know." So call Fred Hand. So I go in there, and I figure this is an opportunity. I know it's an opportunity, right? But here's the thing. I didn't really have that much Spanish guitar music in my repertoire. I had a few pieces, you know, but I wasn't really doing that much Spanish literature because everyone else was, and I was sort of going my own way with that. So I brought in some Granados and some Albinas, but what I also did was I brought some sketches of some Spanish-like ideas that I could riff on.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And when I went into the session, I immediately said to the producers what I had. And they said, "No, we're not interested in your stuff. Let's hear the Granados." Okay. So I played Granados Spanish Dance number 5, right?
Okay.
And you get to that beautiful spot, you know, da 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 dum pam ba dum. And it's just and they go, "Oh, stop. Could you give us just 3 minutes of that? Never mind the other, because you know
of just that,
yeah, just that,
that snippet."
And I knew enough, riffed on, and I knew enough to say, "Sure." I said, "But that's no longer really Granados now. I'm going to be like making it up, so that would be mine, right? Because I'm thinking of royalties." And they go, "Oh yeah, sure, yeah." Right, they didn't care.
Always thinking royalties.
I was thinking royalties. Got to think about the royalties. So so then for 3 hours, so then I did that, and they liked that. And then they said, "Oh, well, you said you brought in some stuff. What did you bring in?" And, of course, now they're in my house, right?
Yeah.
I can do this stuff.
Right.
So I just riffed for 3 hours, and they loved it. And they said, can you come back? I said, I think I can fit it into my schedule. I mean, you got to understand, being a classical guitarist, you know, what that's like economically. And now you walk in, and they, "Mr. Hand, would you like we're ordering. Would you like a steak? Would you like, you know, it's like anything goes. Whatever you want, you can have.
Yeah, all of a sudden you're part of this universe that you had sort of written off.
It's another planet.
Yeah.
It's the commercial world of music. Okay.
All right.
So I did that. I did those two sessions. And then I thought, this was really great. How can I do more of this? So I called the producer and I said, you know, I can do other things. Mm. I don't have to do Spanish music. I write music. He says, well, we're looking for a love theme, you know, for a couple of characters on the show. Why don't you submit something? So I had a little four-track tape recorder, and I did a little thing with four guitars, some really pretty thing. And I sent it to him, and he said, yeah, we really like it. We'd like to do it. Let's do it next week. Why don't you write 8 variations on all that, and you know, for orchestra? And I went, yeah.
Had okay. you even taken?
No, nothing. Zero.
Orchestration, instrumentation
Zero.
Class, nothing.
Didn't know anything.
Nothing at Manus like that?
No. No, huh. Nothing. So, but you know, there's a part of me, just like when I started, the way that I started the Lute was like someone from you know, Joseph Papp's office in Shakespeare in the Park said, we need a lute player. Do you play the lute? And I said, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
I play the lute.
Buy one this
I play the lute. So just like that. So when they said, yeah, we need, you know, 8 variations for orchestra next week, I said, okay.
Yeah.
Got off the phone, freaked out. Then found out, like, who do you call, like, for orchestrations and work with the guy who's brilliant. A week later, we came in with these beautiful orchestrations. I did some. I did what I could. You know, he helped me. He showed me what to do, but he did most of it. And they loved it. And then I worked for them for 15 years.
Is that how you made Kramer versus Kramer?
No, that had nothing to do. That was a result of, as I said, being plugged in and playing on movie scores. And I was called to do that. It was just supposed to be a little vignette in just like a little tiny thing. And then they liked it so much that they said, let's shoot these guys out on the street as street musicians. So they called us back. It was me and Scott Cuny.
Yeah, you're actually in it.
We were actually in it. Yeah. And funny thing is they shot it in front of Tiffany's on Fifth Avenue. And this was at a time when the reason they wanted street musicians because there were a lot of street musicians in New York at that time.
Yeah, there are.
And when we were setting up in front of Tiffany's, there were actually some street musicians on the other side of Fifth Avenue who were just leaving, and they yelled out to us and they said, hey, guys, the money's better on this side of the street. And I shouted back to them. I said, yeah, but I think the money tonight is going to be better on this side of the street. They didn't know it was a movie crew
Look
coming
Look at you.
In.
You're poking fun at the bums.
Oh, I'm not poking fun. They were sweet. They were trying to be helpful.
They are being helpful. That's cool.
So it was not the intention to make this the theme of the movie, but Dustin Hoffman really liked it. And he... I'm told single-handedly said, let's just make that the theme and then use it in the promos and use it in another
scene. The Vivaldi.
Yeah. So, and that got me, you know, a record contract of my own with CBS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did CBS produce the Jazz Antique one?
No, that was RCA.
What was your first CBS recording? Baroque
on
the Street.
On the Street. Yeah. Which actually did well. It was a crossover. It was when the crossover was
That's
first
a funny title,
thing.
Huh?
That was mine. I came up with
your,
that.
Oh,
they had
geez,
all these.
Look what I did.
Listen, you need to take that call
now. I
got to
take this call. Yep, this is very important.
Yeah, so that's about your dry cleaning, isn't
can't
it?
Can't believe. I'm so sorry. Let me turn
no,
this
that's
off.
Okay. I got nothing else to do.
That's a moment. Yeah, you know? You got nothing else to do. It's only raining. So then CBS picks you up?
CBS picks me up.
As a result of Kramer.
That's right. As a result of that arrangement and then being featured that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a big break.
Where was their recording studio?
Oddly enough, at CBS Studios.
Is that
Who would
right?
think?
Oh, so it was where they do the TV and everything? It was all
No, they
building?
Have different studios all over the place. With the TV, that's on 57th Street. Mm-hmm. This was on 52nd Street. I think it's called Black Rock. I'm not sure anymore.
I mean, at this point, you're still in your 20s when all this shit's going on, right?
Baroque on the Street is
not
maybe,
Baroque on the Street, but maybe like when you were playing, your Met debut, whatever.
No, that's in my 30s. All this is happening in my 30s.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, so you were with Bream.
In my 20s.
Oh, in your
In
20s.
My early 24.
Oh, yeah. Like right after college. Yeah. It was your grad school.
Right.
Essentially.
That was my grad school. That's right. And then when
How
I came back.
How many years were you there? 5 years?
Where?
In London.
Oh, no. Just a year. The Fulbright is just a year.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. So we were on to CBS.
So, but you know, if you want to find out what was the transition? When I got back to New York.
Yeah. I mean, that's
I was doing solo concerts and I started teaching at Manus. So mm-hmm. I've been there since then.
Yeah.
And then developing this thing of playing, you know, writings more and playing with other instruments and doing the New York freelance scene, which involved, as I say, you know, record dates and stuff like that. But I was doing concerts. Oh, I left out one thing really important. There was an organization at the time called Affiliate Artists, which I wish was around now for young artists now, because it was the most incredible thing. Their headquarters were in New York, but they had big corporate sponsors like Mobil Oil and you know, car companies and all that. And they would send artists, performing artists, out throughout the United States. And you would get an 8-week appointment, and you go 2 weeks at a time, so 4 weeks throughout the year. And you would have to play two concerts, two informal 45-minute concerts a day. So you got the most incredible training performing, because you had to play over and over. And it was an informal presentation, so you had to talk about the music. So you got very comfortable in an audience. In an audience.
Right.
And, you know,
which is something missing.
It is. It was an incredible training. Audience. It was an incredible service for the people, because I got to hear people that would normally not get to hear this kind of music, got to hear it. It was incredible training for the artists, because an opportunity, because first of all, it provided you with an economic base.
Yeah.
And then you were making, you know, as you were playing all over the place, you could go back and make contacts and come back and play on your own and stuff. And I did that for actually about 7 years. You know?
Oh, so that's what you were doing up until the Meta Point then?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. So you were developing that.
Yeah, and these things weren't all like just, it wasn't like you just do that and then you do this and you do this. I was doing things concurrently. Like, as I was doing, I was also starting to develop Jazz Antiqua, but that was just something that was really an important.
How did you get involved with that? I mean, how, was that an audition process?
Yes, you had to audition. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they had, you know, they had all different kinds of performing artists, but they loved guitarists because we were self-sufficient. They didn't need a piano. Like, if you hired a singer, you have to have accompanist and blah, blah, blah. So they really favored guitar players.
They liked it, and they flew you.
Yeah. Oh, they paid for
everything. See, I think that's obviously been replaced by things like, I guess, like the competitions. But the competitions now, with the exception of GFA, of the GFA tour, they just give you money.
Very different.
You $1,000 if you win.
Yeah, this was a real peanuts. Helping you with your career, build your career.
Yeah.
Not that the GFA doesn't, but, you know, I mean, to win the GFA. How many people can win the GFA? Yeah.
One person
at
wins.
A time, yeah.
I know, I know the other people that have gotten second and third place very well, and
right.
Their careers haven't really, you know, gone.
Well, let's face it, it's much more difficult now. I mean, there's so many more terrific players.
Yeah, there's a lot of terrific players, and also it's a world market now.
But, you know, here's the thing. It is more difficult. And what I, because this comes up all the time in my teaching with my students.
Yes,
but what I see is also a tremendous amount of more creativity. I have, like, for instance, I'm coaching now a trio, two guitars and cello.
Yeah.
And they are kicking ass. I mean, they're unbelievable. And they're playing at places, they're making recordings, they're doing, you know, and it was just a very natural thing that came together while they were in college, you know. But the literature is unusual. It's a fantastic sonic combination.
Are they playing that Villa-Lobos piece?
No, they played a piece by Natalie, a Brazilian composer.
I think
I'm pronouncing it. I think it's
Natalie or something.
Yeah,
no, I know her. I know the name.
And right now we're working on the first book of organ music. It's actually for pedal harpsichord. And, you know, so it's like the cello is playing the bottom and the two guitars. It sounds incredible.
Are the two,
Bach.
What are their names?
Matt Kaplan.
Uh-huh.
And Victor Mean.
Are they undergraduates?
They're graduate students.
And they're both your kids, or one of them with Mike?
They're both mine.
Okay, cool.
And then the cellist's name is Mark Humboldt. And
that's a great combo. I mean, I love that combination.
Well, Humberg. I hope I got his last name right. But just coincidentally,
his
mother is Maxine Newman, who's a terrific cellist, and she and I went to high school together. And now I'm coaching her son. So it's a small world, huh?
Yeah.
But I'm giving you an example, though, of how, you know, not to think of the guitar just the classical guitar, it's just a solo instrument, solo. Right, we get so much of that solo thing. But, you know, first of all, you add two guitars, you get more sound.
Yeah.
And then you put it in that combination, and all of a sudden, your repertoire choices expand incredibly.
That's exactly what I'm going through right now with the dystonia. I got the dystonia, and then I was like, feeling sorry for myself for a year. And I'm kind of happy right now because it did force, I would have never. Mm-hmm. You know, if I kept on just having the weekly concerts at the libraries, I was getting comfortable, you know, playing.
Right.
And so, you know, coming out of that situation and having limitations that actually maybe expand your horizons creatively, because you have to look outside of yourself and outside of the status quo now, because that's just not going to do it, like you're saying. And I've always said one guy from one class gets the job.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, I mean, there's... that's probably not going to be.
But you know, this could
regardless
be,
how good.
It's like this is a great opportunity when you see. Okay, I wasn't thinking of this, but
right.
just like I wasn't when I was in Manistee, I wasn't thinking of jazz and tequila.
No, you weren't.
I wasn't thinking of writing music for soap operas. Right, I wasn't thinking.
And you weren't thinking that when you were with Bream.
I certainly wasn't thinking that when I was Bream. But you know, when I did that. See, it didn't exclude me doing other things. And as a matter of fact, it was quite the contrary. It supported my art.
Right.
Because I didn't take up a lot of time.
Yeah.
I would go in and I would improvise stuff. You know, I could write stuff really quickly. And it was like a little side business that I had. But I was still doing concerts and doing my own artistic thing. But I had an income, which was nice.
When you were doing your solo concerts, again, that was all, like you were saying, that was all your original compositions as
not
well.
All.
Not all. Not all.
When I first
bit.
Started doing solo concerts, I was traveling with a
Because right now you play
Whaler.
Bach, you play a little bit of everything.
And right. Well.
Mostly your stuff, though. I'd yeah. say it's like half and half. Half
yeah,
you, half
sure.
other people.
When I first started out, though, I used to travel with a vihuela, with a lute, and a guitar. And I had everything on wheels. I would literally be pushing all this stuff through the airport. But it made for an interesting, sonically, you know. At a concert, you heard yeah. these different sounds.
Well, you still do the. Pieces. You still pull lute out. You opened with the lute last time I saw you downtown.
Oh yeah,
at the Brook or whatever.
I'm doing less and less on the lute. My lute phase is. I think I've gotten past my lute phase.
That's
I've had an,
well,
I've
that's
had
good.
Enough with the lute. Enough with the lute already. Yeah.
It is so quiet.
It's very so quiet, except that when they put that pickup on it, and then I
except
powerful,
yeah that one
then
concert
from a powerful man
than that.
Yeah.
God, that must have been a nightmare for him. I mean,
for
just,
who?
For James Levine.
So you keep talking about, let's call him Levine, you know.
You call Levine? Is that the way you pronounce
think so,
it?
So, yeah.
I've always said Levine.
You can call him Levine. I don't care.
Well, my boss is Jonathan Levine.
Oh, well, there you go.
But he calls himself Levine.
Who does?
James Levine.
Yes.
Is that right? So it's Levine?
It is Levine.
See, you hear that? That's good. So everybody's
learning something.
You
learned
today.
Something today.
Not just me, but my
yeah,
seven
but you
listeners.
You keep referring to this as a horrible incident. And I'm telling you, like, this is like one
this
of the great things. This
well,
is
definitely, well,
pinnacle of my career.
Well, definitely.
You're saying it's horrible.
Everybody, I didn't say it was horrible.
You said a horrible experience for him. Wait, let's roll the tape back. You said something.
It's got to be scary for him when that happens. When
I
he's
don't care.
Conducting.
We're talking about me now. This is my experience. I had a great time.
You don't think he wants to come on with John Williams and have
you keep
a, just an
saying
awesome...
saying he. You don't think he. Who you, are you interviewing here?
James Levine. Levine.
In your dreams.
No, I know. It's not going to happen. Well, maybe it will. Maybe it will.
Well, good luck to you.
Who knows?
Good luck to you, lad.
He doesn't want to come here to the studio?
I'm not saying anything.
Studio hey, look, apartment?
I can't work like this. Can you cover that up?
I know.
You have this. Brett
they
has this beautiful black table and it's got a little rip in it. And it stands out because everything is so shiny, and we're both looking at this tiny little rip. I think Brett's more upset than I am.
There's a crack in the table, and it's really setting into our OCD, mild OCD, which I
don't,
think is...
You know, if you keep pulling it, it will actually expand.
It's got like a little bit of like fuzz in it, though.
Buzz or fuzz?
Fuzz. So it's like pulling it at yours and my artistic OCD.
You know what? There's a crack right here. Did you see that?
Yeah, I know. Worse. That's what I'm saying.
This is not good. I think you need a new apartment. I was going to say a new table.
I'm going to move out.
Well, I mean, but you start with the table. The next thing, you need an apartment. Anyway, listen, take care of this because I can't work like this.
I will. I will. I'll definitely fix that because that is horrible. Look yeah. at this. We can't stop thinking about it.
I know. Let's talk about that some more.
So what happened then? So, I mean, not what happened then, but I mean, that sort of – when Jazz Antiqua broke up, did it break up because of writing credit?
No.
I mean, because
no.
it says Jazz Antiqua. I think it's the title of the album, Jazz Antiqua with Fred Hand.
It says I'm Frederick Hand's Jazz Antiqua.
Yeah, so I'm dealing with this right now with naming my ensemble. Maybe mm-hmm. you can help me. But I'm having the same sort of issue because I'm writing the music.
Right.
I'm providing the practice space. I have all the equipment. And I kind of feel like I want to hold on to it. I don't want something to happen like what happened with the duo when it broke up and that was it. The duo was done. But at the same time, I want everybody to feel ownership of it so that they put it into the same
I
amount of work.
I completely understand what you're saying because I dealt with that.
So and I don't know whether to call it the Brett Williams Quintet
well,
or whether
before you get into what to call it, let me okay. just tell you what I think is an important issue. And it's not an easy thing. That on the one hand, this is an outgrowth. It's a direct outgrowth of your artistry and your artistic expression.
Yeah.
And you have to decide if that's what it's going to be, then, and I hate to use the word control, but you want to maintain control over this organization.
I want to maintain.
Because you want, yeah, you do, because you want this to be, you want to be able to have this group play the music that you want to express, right?
Yeah.
Once you open it up to cooperative, it should be, if people are going to just put in their time and effort for nothing, then they should have ownership too. I mean, it's only fair. So what I did was I said, guys, this is something I'm creating. I will pay you for your time.
Yes. Okay?
Okay. I oftentimes didn't get paid anything. So in other words, I made sure that they always got paid. Now, I said, I want your creative input and output. I want you to feel that this is your group too. But at the end of the day, I'm the one that's shouldering the financial responsibility of it. And above all, I want to be able to write music for this vehicle.
Well, yeah, not only that, but it's also, I've just always found that things seem to work better, whether it's me or somebody else, when there's a leader. And by that,
makes
I mean
it easier.
A final authority that everybody, so that everybody doesn't feel, because sometimes right. when you appoint everybody the leader, then people who normally wouldn't feel like they need to have an opinion about sure. something formulate opinions for the sake of having an opinion, and it ends up being incredibly problematic yeah. and muddies the waters.
Well, you know,
it doesn't necessarily
need to be
muddied.
They say a dictatorship is it's a very good, you know, use of time.
right.
that you just, this
it's
is
efficient.
What it is.
It's efficient. But I mean, so that's the thing. It's not really an ego trip. It's more about an efficiency.
That's right.
Example.
And I think also, I mean, okay, we say it's not an ego trip. But if yeah. this is about your creation and an expression of your music, then it should be your thing, right? So it's not a simple thing, because you do want to have creative people and you want to welcome their contribution.
Yeah, you don't want them to leave because they feel like, oh, well, I'm just doing this.
And so you have
I'm
walk
helping
a
this guy
you
out.
You have to walk a delicate balance there. And honestly, I felt after 7 years, a lot of that struggle was that balance, walking that balance. Of course, there were guys that wanted to go much more deeper into a jazz thing, which was not my thing, you know, and I respected what they wanted to do. I just didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
And at the end, you know, it was like I had done it for 7 years. I had given it my all. We had a great run, but I was exhausted from it. And also, it had completely taken over my life. I mean, that was all I was doing.
Yeah.
And I didn't want that to be all I was doing. So I'm very happy I did it. I don't have any regrets.
It wasn't – nothing personal happened with any of the guys?
Oh, like, sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That has to happen. You know, that's not going to not happen. When you
it's
have
not going
to
not happen, right?
No,
there can't be a group in the world where the guys – I mean
– And, you know, you have to deal with that. And I'm saying I did deal with it, but after a while I didn't want to deal with it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't terrible or anything like that, but it was like enough – that was enough, you know.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Jeez. So, I mean, writing credit was never an issue with the group?
No, because
I've heard a lot of, I mean, especially in the rock world,
it
a
wasn't
lot of people
in my
break
we
up
had,
because of writing
no,
credit.
No, I did most of the writing, and occasionally one of the guys wrote something, and they wrote it. It was theirs. You know, there wasn't any question about that.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so you just gave them the writing.
Oh, of course.
Was, yeah, I mean,
no
that's
issue.
What I would be
if I
to.
If they wrote it, they wrote it.
Well, and like you're saying, the money thing, too, is like I have no problem splitting the funds down the line at all. Yeah. I need someone to be the leader.
Sure. Of course.
And if, you know.
Of course. You know, ultimately.
If I'm the one forming.
Ultimately, you're running an arts organization.
Right.
You have to find a way, and there are ways, okay,
yeah.
Where you're not always working for nothing.
Yeah.
Right? And so you could be a nonprofit or whatever. There are many ways to do this. But at first, you just want to see if you can get something going that's viable, and that means, you know, that's even worth doing.
Yeah.
So the first thing is you have to have the product. And then you can figure out how to organize this that works for everybody. You know, sometimes your pay is not money. It's something else.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some other things come from it. So you'll yeah. work it out.
But thanks.
Above all, get the music happening first.
yeah. First we get the music, then we get the money, and then we get the
then
girls.
Then you figure the name.
Right. And yeah. then we figure out the name.
Yeah.
But the so right now though, what's happening? I'm with you. I mean, what are you doing artistically right now? You came out. When was your last album? It was
It was a while ago, and I started making another album, and I was not really thrilled with the situation in terms of the recording studio and everything. So I have about a half an album done,
mm-hmm.
and I'm definitely going to finish that. But what I want to do now, and I've started on it. Make some videos that I want to put up on YouTube.
Yeah.
Right now, though, you see, once the year starts, the season, like I'm working with the Met. I'm in two productions right now. I'm in Otello. Like I played last night in Otello on stage. You know, I'm playing tonight in Francesca di Rimini, which is the first opera I told you about that I started with them.
Yeah.
And now they've got me playing the first bit in the Pit. And I'm dressed in a tuxedo, okay? Except that under my tuxedo, I've got tights, and I'm wearing these, like, incredibly, like, gold slippers. Okay, I go into the pit with that because when I walk out of the pit, immediately two wardrobe people descend on me, and they strip me. Okay, I'm not kidding. The tux shirt is a breakaway shirt. They just pull it off. They pull my pants down, okay?
Uh-huh.
I am wearing tights. Okay?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then they throw on the costume, which is everything's Velcro, you know? And they get me back up on the stage. Their costume change is done from tux to this very elaborate, ornate costume in about a minute. It's like a pit stop.
Yeah.
And then I'm on stage, so I'm doing that. And then I go out in the third act and do another whole bit. So the Met schedule right now, I'm doing about, like this week, four shows.
Oh, man, that's awesome.
Yeah, so this whole month, this whole year has been great, you know, working with the Met.
Plus, I love them. I'm going to the whole ring cycle this year.
Fantastic.
All four of them.
Fantastic. Have you've been before, right?
Oh, I've been to the Met, yeah.
Well, it's an incredible, I love the Met. It's an incredible place.
Love it. This that's is why one I'm the great... getting the job when you die.
Well, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Did no, I mention I have to leave right now?
But so, yes.
I'm just afraid now you're going to kill me before
I'm not going to kill you.
Okay.
Good. I promise.
All right.
Kill you with kindness. So how is this, Fred? Do you feel good about everything? Is there anything else you want to talk about?
No. I mean, I thought this was a lot of fun.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Okay. So
now, is there a way that you want to end it or just like
no,
that's it?
No. This is it. This is it. This is the ending.
I loved it.
Are you sure?
It was just you and I hanging out, right?
That's all it was.
Yeah.
Not too much, right? Thank you for joining me, Fred Han.
It was my pleasure.
I love you, man. I'll talk to you soon.
I love you, too. Take care.
All right, guys. That's it. That's Fred Han. I hope you enjoyed him. I know I did. I always enjoy my time with Fred. This is from his RCA release from 1986, his Jazz Antiqua album. This is Cantigas de Santa Maria by Fred Han. You enjoy it, his little Renaissance jazz fusion. Anyway, see you guys next week with Bill Kenningeiser. Spread the word. The podcast is getting around. We're up towards around 600 listeners total, which is a lot, I think, for a podcast of this nature. I don't know how the sponsors feel. They may feel differently. They may just not like me. But we'll see what happens. I'm still working on that. Anybody has any ideas about sponsorship, you can always contact me at Brett. That's B-R-E-T, one T in Brett. Brett at brettwilliamsmusic.com. If you have any other suggestions, let me know. All right, talk to you guys soon. Bye.